from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim in for Michael Krasny. The devastations from Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and now Maria has shined a spotlight on the vulnerability of coastal regions. In his new book, Coasts in Crisis, UC Santa Cruz oceanographer Gary Griggs warns us that we are totally unprepared for the likely effects of sea level rise.
If we think Irma and Harvey were bad, put that around the entire world and raise sea level.
Gary Griggs joins us in the studio to talk about his book and his proposed solutions after the news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim in for Michael Krasny. Millions of people are currently feeling the effects of Hurricanes Maria, Irma, and Harvey. And our guest today, UC Santa Cruz professor Gary Griggs, says millions more are vulnerable to being hit by a serious storm. There are about 61 million people living along the Gulf and Atlantic coast. Griggs is here to talk about the recent hurricanes, as well as sea level rise and other threats to our coastal regions, which is what he explores in his new book, Coasts in Crisis. Gary Griggs, welcome to Forum.
Thanks for having me.
I guess we should just sort of get to the topic of the recent couple of weeks, and it seems like we've been hit by one hurricane after another. There's been Harvey in Texas, Irma in Florida, and of course we've been hearing a lot about Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. I know there's a hurricane season, but there's also been a lot of talk about how global climate change might be a factor, and I wanted to sort of pick your brain on that. What do you think?
Well, not being a hurricane person specifically, working on the West Coast, but having certainly looked at those and written about them, I think there's growing consensus that those factors that sort of amplify hurricanes or initiate them, which is basically warmer tropical water, warmer air, are all going in the wrong direction. So that I think there's still some question whether we're going to have more hurricanes, more intense hurricanes, but the way this season has been going, it certainly looks like there is some connections here that are becoming more obvious.
In your book, you say that hurricanes have been responsible for more loss of life in the United States than any other natural hazard. That was really interesting to me. And I wondered how much of that statistic is due to the fact that we haven't prepared as much for hurricanes, or maybe the policies haven't gone through as much? Because I'm thinking about earthquakes, and it seems like we've lessened the death toll and sort of devastation of earthquakes in a way that doesn't seem to be happening with hurricanes as much.
No, I think you're right. And I think we also tend to have, you know, a really large earthquake every 10 years, every 15, every 20 years. And in a great earthquake like San Francisco, 1906, you know, maybe every 50 or so years in the U.S. But our building codes have kept up with that. Mm-hmm. And in the Loma Prieta earthquake of 1989, 6.9 magnitude, we had 65 deaths. The same magnitude earthquake, 7.0, in Haiti, there were something around 200,000 lives lost because of the way they build. And I think hurricanes, some of the areas that are most hurricane prone, Miami or Florida, the Gulf Coast, are those areas that are building the most rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it showed with some of these tower cranes in Miami that weren't designed for hurricane winds. They were designed to put up buildings, but, you know, two of those collapsed. So when you get winds of, you know, over 150 miles an hour, and there's really four things that happen during a hurricane that lead to damage and loss of life. It's these extreme wind velocities. It's the storm surge, or the water rising in elevation, mm-hmm. because of the strong onshore winds, large waves, and then the rainfall that follows, which is what really happened with Harvey in Houston. Yeah, and those are, you know, we've not done a good job by any stretch. We just keep building in these areas. Property keeps being bought and sold.
And I think you're talking about, like, in Houston, there's been a lot of conversation about how they paved over, is it the prairie grass there that used to soak up some of this water, but that's been sort of built on so
exactly,
yeah, and those regulations aren't staying aren't being implemented, I guess. We here in the Bay Area, I think we like to pride ourselves in thinking, while we don't have hurricanes, we are very aware of, you know, environmental concerns out there and sea level rise, which is the topic of your book. How are we doing in terms of meeting these challenges?
Well, I think California is way ahead of the rest of the country for many reasons. I think we've had really enlightened leadership, particularly Governor Brown. Sea level, we still got states that either are outlawing or not allowing people to talk about it, and we are out on the front line. So I think we have a lot more discussion going on.
Mm-hmm.
The difficult thing is, how do you put that into action? Because that's when the dollars become important. And we have some incredible infrastructure development that's at stake. But taking that first step is a really expensive button to push, and we really haven't gotten there yet.
Well, maybe I should back up a little bit here. You've been advising a lot of state and local governments on the sea level rise, and you are saying that by, I guess, 2030, the sea is going to rise by 6 inches. What does that look like? I always have a hard time imagining that. So if you could sort of play out some scenarios about what a 6-inch sea rise would look like if it happened today and we haven't become prepared for it.
Right. Well, one of the places that's been most widely, I think, publicized is the Embarcadero. And one of the things that's really important to keep in mind is there are short-term events that are going to be much more problematic and damaging probably until 2050. So these are these king tides. They're El Nino events when mm-hmm. sea level can be elevated for a foot or more over 2 or 3 months. And we've got periods of large waves and high tides. So those are going to keep hammering us. And then sea level is this ramp with everything else riding on top of it. Ultimately, sea level rise is going to be the big problem. Mm-hmm. So in the Embarcadero today, at a king tide, which happened twice a year, we've got water lapping over onto the sidewalks and mm-hmm. onto the street. So if you add 6 inches, it's really flooding those areas, not just a few waves breaking over. San Francisco International and Oakland International Airports, their runways go underwater within about 16 inches of high tide. So they were built, understandably, without dealing with sea level rise. But those are some big structures we've got to think about.
There's other infrastructure. I think you mentioned in your book that we have power plants next to.
Right.
But can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, around the bay, there are dozens of two major facilities, power plants, which are typically very close to sea level because they're pumping in cooling water. And all of our sewage treatment plants tend to be right at sea level because wastewater flows downhill and they want it at the lowest possible spot. But when you start raising sea level, first it backs up the discharge lines or the outflow lines, and it gets into these facilities very quickly. So those are two pieces of critical infrastructure that we're aware of, but we haven't done anything about figuring out what the next step is when we decide we got to move, we got to relocate.
Yeah, I didn't even really know that we had this critical infrastructure near the water. And I feel like, but maybe I just missed it, that there's not a lot of talk in terms of our policymakers or even local governments or the utilities on how to address this. Am I just missing something, or is there a conversation going on?
Well, there are different groups getting together. One of the big topics now is resilience.
And what does that
and
mean?
And resilience. Well, that's a good question. I mean, there's conferences and workshops, and there's this new program around the Bay, Design, Resilience by Design. And I think people want to use a simple word to try to describe a really complicated phenomenon because it makes you feel better about it. But in fact, as I look around the state or look around the planet, you know, if you look at Hurricane Irma or Harvey or Sandy or Katrina, we don't have anything that's resilient. Resilient seems to be let's rebuild with federal mm-hmm. money. So there's a big gap there between talking about it and then taking a step towards actually either eliminating or reducing the risk rather than just resilience to me isn't rebuilding as fast as we can.
Oh, that's interesting. So the conversation, if I'm understanding you correctly, in terms of these power plants and whatever and stuff like that, is sort of like, well, if it happens, we'll just rebuild. Am I understanding that correctly?
I think that's where we've been so far. I don't think, to my knowledge, we have any plans to replace these sewage treatment plants or power plants. And they're, you know, multi-million dollar or more facilities. So these aren't cheap fixes, but it's a big button to push.
We are talking to Gary Griggs. He's a distinguished professor of earth sciences at UC Santa Cruz. He's got a book out called Coasts in Crisis, A Global Challenge. We want to hear from you. Do you live along the coast? What concerns do you have about coastal dangers? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email us your questions at forum@kqed.org or post them on kqed.org/forum. I wanted to sort of back up really broadly here because your book has a lot of really interesting historical facts about humans and them living on the coast. And I was really interested to find out that there's a theory about sea level rise back in the day and how we went from a hunter-gatherer culture to an agrarian culture. So could you talk about that? And what was interesting to me is we've always sort of had to contend with sea level rising and I guess falling.
Yeah, it's an interesting sort of coincidence that after the last ice age ended about 20,000 years ago, sea level rose about 400 feet over about 10,000 years. That's pretty fast.
Yeah.
And about 8,000 years ago, it leveled off. And for the last 8,000 years, it's been pretty constant. But that happens to coincide with the entire period of human civilization. So humans have never had to deal with sea level rise before. But what that pause in sea level rise did was stabilize deltas and coastal floodplains where people could actually begin to farm, raise animals, and begin the rudiments of civilization. And now, all of a sudden, beginning, you know, around 1900 or so, with carbon and greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, that rate of rise has gone up, you know, three or four or fivefold what it had been before. And now, for the first time, we're just beginning to come to grips with what does that mean that earlier humans did not have to deal with.
And what, I mean, I guess what I was curious about was you hear a lot of folks from the right saying, oh, well, we've seen these sort of sea level rise and fall. And reading your book, I was sort of thinking, oh, I can sort of see where that idea comes from. So why is it so much more concerned right now, or what's happening right now that's different from that sort of historical trajectory?
So historically, sea level has risen and fallen up to 400 feet. But if you look at the plot of sea level rise over time, which we know really well from a whole lot of geological evidence, sea level has never been stable for very long. And what we call today sea level wouldn't have been sea level 10,000 years ago. It would have been, 250 feet lower. The big difference is during all those other major changes or fluctuations, there weren't any people here. There was no civilization. There was no cities. There was no industrial development. So right now, there's about 150 million people around the planet living within 3 feet of high tide, and eight of the world's 10 megacities, over 10 million people, are all on shorelines. So those present what I will boldly say is the biggest challenge civilization has ever had to face.
Yeah, and I guess why do you say that? What are you seeing outside the United States that sort of leads you to that conclusion?
Well, in particular, some of the huge cities in Southeast Asia, whether it's Hong Kong, Singapore, Guangzhou, the coastal cities in India, in the Philippines, just so many of the world's big cities, for logical reasons that we talk about in that first chapter on why
and
coastlines
that is
made sense.
Trade or climate?
Yeah, exactly. Trade, access to the ocean, agricultural soil, fresh water coming in from rivers. It just made, I mean, today people, you know, you live in San Francisco instead of Merced.
Right.
The climate's more reasonable, but we weren't thinking about future sea level. I mean, there are those other hazards of tsunamis and hurricanes that we've been aware of, but sea level rise for us as humans is a pretty recent phenomenon.
here you've mentioned the Embarcadero in terms of how we're seeing the sea level rise starting to affect us here in California. Are there other parts of the California coastline that are changing because of the impacts of rising sea levels?
Oh, yeah. There's a wonderful website now, this King Tides Initiative. And a king tide is basically when the moon is closest to the Earth and that system is close to the sun twice a year, where sea level can be inches higher than normal. And that doesn't sound like much, but where the ground is very, very level, that can move sea level in a long way. And to give sort of some context to that, that many people don't realize, it's 100 miles from the Golden Gate to Sacramento, yet Sacramento is an ocean port.
Huh. Explain that to me.
So sea level goes all the way into Sacramento. We take ocean-going ships that far in the Delta and the canals and so forth. So 6 inches of rise in the Golden Gate is also 6 inches along these levees of the Sacramento.
Right.
But there are a number of places. This King Tides website shows the sort of the off ramps there into Marin and Mill Valley. That area goes underwater at King Tides. People think it's rainfall, but it's ocean water. It's happening in Huntington Beach, a number of places. Capitola gets inundated at really high tides and large storm waves. So we don't think about it because we don't see it that often, but it's a problem already without any more sea level rise.
And it sounds like it's getting a little confused because it comes with the rain, so we just think it's like flooding from the rain. But
right.
The sea level is actually playing a big part of this as well. We're talking
right.
to Gary Griggs. He is the Distinguished Professor of Earth Sciences at UC Santa Cruz. He's got a new book out called Coasts in Crisis, A Global Change. We'd love to hear if you have any questions or if you live along the coast and have any stories to share. Please give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. And you can also get in touch with us on Twitter or Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. We do actually have a call here. We've got Ben in Oakland. Hey, Ben, welcome to the forum.
Hi, thanks. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Hello. Well, I work on sea level rise adaptation planning, and I wanted to, first of all, say I very much appreciate you guys tackling this issue, which is extremely important and something we're all going to have to face a lot more. I'm a city planner with a policy research organization, and we have been working on a planning process for Ocean Beach in San Francisco, and I've actually met Gary before. It's a conversation about this. Hello. And I wanted to send a slightly more optimistic note, just in the sense, not in terms of big picture, obviously this is a very scary thing that we all have to grapple with, but I did want to say that there are a lot of folks in the policy world who are working very hard to try to figure out how to plan around sea level rise. When I started working on this issue 6 or 7 years ago, virtually nobody in sort of planning practice was talking about climate adaptation or sea level rise adaptation as a way of doing planning. And that's planning for how things will change over time and how you think about uncertainty and how you spend resources in an appropriate way to plan for these kinds of challenges. And since that time, it really has developed as a discipline, and the city of San Francisco in particular has done a lot of work. They have guidelines in place for how to think about capital projects and not wasting public money or building things that have a lot of adaptive capacity or preparing for the hazards that come with sea level rise. And the Ocean Beach Master Plan, which is what we've worked on, is one example of that, where there's exactly what your guest was describing. There's a large sewage treatment plant and associated pipes and stuff right on the coast that are threatened by coastal storms.
Hey, Ben, I have a question for you. It sounds like I think we all agree that there's a lot of talk and people are really thinking about this and thinking of master plans and policy books. Do you see the money coming to implement these plans, the laws being passed to make these regulations, required by developers? How are you seeing it in terms of the action front?
Increasingly, you have state resources being deployed towards planning, and it is still planning. It takes a long time to think about what you're going to do with $1 billion worth of infrastructure. But you're starting to get dollars apportioned to try to solve these problems. You're also having policies put in place both at the local level. San Francisco is in the process of updating its local coastal plan, which is required by the Coastal Commission. And then also the Coastal Commission itself, which regulates the coastal zone, has issued a lot of guidance for trying to update our plans to take account of sea level rise and not permit things that will be in harm's way and how to kind of adapt the things we do have. So it's a slow process. It's a deliberative process. But it is something that people are working on quite a lot.
Well, Ben, thanks so much for giving a call. It was great to talk to you, and thanks for sharing your story about what's happening in Ocean Beach. Gary Griggs, you've been consulting folks around the state. I was wondering what you thought of that question. It sounds like there's a lot of thought and planning going on. It sounds like from the last caller that money is starting to be put into place. Is it happening fast enough?
I think you asked the right question, which is what's actually being done because of the money involved. And I don't think there's any question that there's a lot of groups, and the caller has, you know, been part of one of those. The Ocean Beach plan is one of only three I know of where there's actually a plan. There's also one at Surfers Point in Ventura where they've moved back a bike path and a parking lot, and one down in Pacifica. But so far, we haven't had to pick up any big buildings and move them. Mm-hmm. And I think the plans, I've been involved in enough planning efforts. There's certainly plenty of discussion going on. And right now the Coastal Commission has required every coastal community to update their LCP or their local coastal program with a sort of a sea level rise response. But it's one thing to write the response.
Right. And it's another thing to get the money to actually implement
exactly.
it. And I just saw that there's a new PPIC study out that says California needs to spend at least $34 billion to upgrade dams, levees, and other flood management infrastructure, and that accomplishing these upgrades within 25 years would mean spending $1.4 billion a year. That's twice what we're currently investing in these projects. Did we see a taste of what it might mean if we don't ramp up this investment with Oroville?
Exactly. And I think, you know, it's one of the times we could make major changes is after a big disaster. And it's been often said that we have about a 6 to 8 week window after a major disaster to implement anything. And in California, for example, we've often upgraded our seismic code after a big earthquake. And then within 2 or 3 months, we're on to another crisis. So that window is pretty short. And, you know, Oroville, what's going to be the next crisis? But many of those dams, levees are really old, and we don't think about putting that money into them on a regular basis.
We are talking with Gary Griggs. He's a distinguished professor of earth sciences at UC Santa Cruz. He's got a new book out, Coasts in Crisis, A Global Challenge. He's going to stay with us for the next part of the show. I'm Queenie Kim, and you're listening to Forum. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Queenie Kim in for Michael Krasny. And we're talking with UC Santa Cruz oceanographer Gary Griggs about the challenges facing our coastal zones and how we can protect them and the people living there. We want to hear from you. Do you live along a coastal zone? Do you live along the coast, or what concerns do you have in terms of coastal dangers? Please give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions at forum@kqed.org, or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. Gary Griggs, we got a couple questions here that are calling on your expertise. Jenny tweets, how susceptible is a place like Pleasure Point in Santa Cruz to sea level rise, and especially with those big walls that they have there?
So Pleasure Point and a good portion of the California coast either is backed by cliffs or low bluffs. And those are the places where sea level rise is not a particular issue at the time. At the present time, Pleasure Point's maybe 25, 30 feet high. So an inch or 2 or 6 inches or a foot isn't going to make a big difference there. And the seawalls without getting into the issues surrounding seawalls, it's basically concrete that, that mimics the natural rock, so the seawall will not have any effect on that. There are other issues there, basically large storm waves at high tides, but at the present time, a sea level rise there isn't a big issue for the near future.
What about beaches like Stinson?
Stinson, much different, just because it is a low-lying sand spit. I mean, it has already been, you know, inundated in past big El Nino events like 1983. So that's an area that I would say is much more vulnerable than a cliffed area.
Let's go for a call here. We got Greg from Redwood City. Hey, Greg, welcome to Forum.
Good morning. I just wanted to know, I lived in Miami Beach for many years, and I had a, both a canal front and a ocean or a bayfront home. And, you know, when the storms come in, it is, you know, quite an episode. And, you know, even though you pay quite a bit of money for flood insurance and hurricane insurance, the homeowner is left with quite a big bill with the deductibles, and just the damage or the cleanup is just takes forever. But, you know, just like the thinking about the feasibility of trying to build up these properties and locations. So I wondered if especially anybody's talking about replenishing like the groundwater that we've been sucking out of the earth for all these years, if that would actually mitigate some of the sea level rise.
Oh, that's an interesting question. Does the groundwater have anything to do with sea level rise? Gary Griggs.
You know, that's a really good question. And a couple of years ago, there was a National Academy of Science study that Governor Schwarzenegger had requested on sea level in California, what we could expect, California, Oregon, and Washington, actually. And there's the big factors that are affecting sea level rise over the last century, leaving out groundwater just for a moment. And those are thermal expansion. So as we heat water, it expands, sort of like the water in your water heater does, while you leave a little space at the top. Hmm. And that was believed to be over the maybe the first half of the last century, maybe longer, the major contributing factor. But now we believe that ice melt is the big factor. And if we look at the main repositories of ice on the planet, we have all the continental glaciers, which are the Alps and the Andes and the Himalayas and Patagonia. Those are actually quite small. They're melting quite rapidly. And if we melt all of those, we would only produce, I should say only, about 2 feet of sea level rise. That would be a problem for SFO and Oakland and the Embarcadero, but globally that's pretty modest.
Right.
Greenland has 24 feet of sea level rise equivalent.
You mean if all melting, the ice in Greenland melted, we would see the sea level rise by 24 feet?
24 feet. And that would probably inundate at least a billion people across the planet, maybe more. But Antarctica is the elephant in the room, and there's about 190 feet of sea level rise equivalent. So if you put those all together, it's about 216 feet, and that's probably half the world's people. Now, that has happened in the geologic past. We've had periods that we called hothouse Earth when we know probably all the ice melted. This is without humans being involved at all. So there are conditions, methane escaping from the ocean and other things. And there's been times we called snowball Earth when we think the entire Earth was frozen under natural conditions. But the difference is there was no people around. Mm-hmm. One of the factors that we considered in this report was how much water is being pumped out of the ground, used, discharged, that then ends up in the ocean.
Oh, interesting.
And there's some estimates of that. And it, in our estimation in this report, it looks like that's just about balanced by how much water we're storing in reservoirs.
So is there any movement to not put that water into the ocean? And this is a conversation that's been had by a lot of environmentalists as well, that it's sort of it's actually sort of unique in our time in human history that we're just putting all of our waste into the ocean. I had never thought of it in terms of sea level rise, that could be contributing to it.
Yeah. So it's a minor component, and it's being, as I say, we think essentially balanced by water we're trapping in reservoirs. So any of that water that's used, whether wherever we are, we put it into a river, into the ocean along the California coast. Virtually every city and community puts their wastewater treated to at least secondary level back in the ocean. But as we're running out of fresh water, you know, we're looking to maybe a few more dams. I don't think we're going to build a lot more. Mm-hmm. Maybe desalination, which is happening in Southern California, and wastewater treatment or retreatment, which is not a technical problem. It's a social acceptability problem. So there's now some movement in that direction, which would solve a number of problems.
Well, we have some comments of people sharing their experiences with floods and whatnot. We have Janelle who writes, I live in Sonoma, fairly close to the sloughs and the northernmost border of the bay wetlands. At what point should I worry about saltwater intrusion into our well? Sonoma has quite a bit of flooding already along Highway 12 and 37.
So seawater intrusion, which is the flow of seawater into coastal aquifers, has been a problem in California and coastal states around the nation, in fact, around the world for as long as we've been digging wells. And basically, there's a balance between the freshwater flow. We have evaporation from the ocean, precipitation, percolates down into the groundwater, flows out through rivers. We pump it out through wells. It moves down to the coast. And that freshwater level in the groundwater should come out to just about where sea level is. But as we lower those water levels in the wells or sea level rises, we push that sea level or that seawater plume or sort of wedge further inland. So that is definitely a problem. And that's where a few inches can make a big difference.
Yeah. So it's not just your area flooding, but it could actually disrupt your water source there. And we've got a call from Harvey in Berkeley. Harvey, welcome to Forum.
Thanks for the show. And my question is, the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant, which sits on California's coastline, draws 2.5 billion gallons of seawater from the Pacific Ocean each and every day to cool its two reactors. And if we get sea rise before the plant is slated to close in 2025, will it curtail the outflow of the seawater after it circulates around the two reactors, causing the reactors to heat up and go into a nuclear meltdown?
I think it's scheduled to close in 2020 or 2022. I think they have hopefully planned for their intakes to be well below the surface level. I don't think the amount of sea level rise, even at the maximum projections, is going to be, I mean, that's going to be inches by the time they close. So I don't think that's going to be an issue there.
We have a call from Roberta in San Leandro. Hey, Roberta, welcome to Forum.
Oh, you got Tom in San Francisco, I believe.
Oh, okay, Tom.
On a couple of months ago, in San, on Friday with Nina Kim, she had a person from the Coastline Commission, and at the end of the show, he said a 2 degrees rise in temperature equates to a 26 foot rise in water in the ocean level. And I haven't, and I'm wondering if that's still in the ballpark. And the other question I have is, all of the glacier melt is salt-free water. It's fresh water. What's going to happen to when all of that fresh water dilutes into the ocean? Thank you.
So the first question is a complicated one, because what typically happens in the ocean, this is the issue of thermal expansion, is most of the change in ocean temperature occurs in the upper 1,000 feet or so. Mm-hmm. So the surface water, you find out you go out swimming in the ocean, a little warmer in the summer, cooler in the winter. That changes significantly. You know, it may be 5, 10, 15, 20 degrees, but that's a pretty thin layer of the ocean. It's the lower 3, 4, 5, 10, 15,000 feet where a little bit of temperature difference over that huge depth can make a big difference. So I think that if we change the whole ocean by 2 degrees, that's probably right, but it takes a lot of heat to change the entire deep ocean. And I don't think we're anywhere near that. That's not saying we shouldn't be concerned about it, but we got 330 million cubic miles of seawater. We've already changed the pH of it, and we're changing the surface temperature slowly, but that's a ways into the future. The other question, let's see, was...
You know, I can't remember it myself, but let's... Yeah, I'm sorry, Tom.
If fresh water is diluting the ocean water.
Oh, right, Right, right. Okay. So there's no question of freshwater runoff from rivers, whether it's the Mississippi or the Amazon or the Nile, dilutes and rides on top of the ocean water for, miles offshore in some cases. The water around Antarctica, because that ice is melting, is essentially fresh. I mean, that does affect local circulation and mixing and sinking and so forth and so on. And it's one of the things that the melting of the Arctic, Greenland, so forth, as well as changes in warming of the ocean, that's led to some of these concerns about this overturning in the Atlantic and the circulation and what that will do for large-scale ocean properties. But so far, I think the amount of water coming in is still pretty modest compared to the total amount of salt water in the ocean, and we're not over the ocean as a whole changing its salinity.
We have a couple more comments here. Jonathan writes, are the Sacramento River Delta and its levees vulnerable to an earthquake? How does sea level rise affect that vulnerability? Yeah, a lot of questions for you all. It's like you're the go-to guy. You're like the Dear Abby of sea level rise.
And I have another question. There's something in my backyard that concerns me.
Yeah, right. We have actually a couple questions here from the staff, too, that they wanted me to throw in. But go ahead and answer that question. Sacramento River Delta.
Yeah. Well, you know, we had that earthquake up in Napa, a couple of years ago that we discovered was on a fault that really hadn't been mapped. Mm-hmm. Certainly there are faults, you know, throughout California. There's concerns in the past about Oroville and faults in that area, how active they are. And the Delta is certainly very vulnerable in the sense of the sediments and their potential for liquefaction and subsidence. I would say the amount of sea level we're talking about isn't going to have any significant effect on earthquakes because it's modest in the scale of the forces that we're talking about that generate earthquakes.
We have a call from Michael at Stanford. Michael, welcome to Forum.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I have a question that kind of stems off of things I've read about Hurricane Harvey and Irma. I've read that a lot of the people that are in the flood zone and should have national flood insurance policies don't have them.
Right.
They either didn't renew them or never got them, and there hasn't been enforcement by, you know, the mortgage servicers or the banks or whoever of that requirement. I'm wondering how true that is for California. We have a lot of people that live in the coastal high hazard zone and in other floodplains. And do you have any information about whether that lack of compliance with the flood insurance and management of risk is happening here too?
That's a great question. Are people getting flood insurance, or are they being required to get that insurance?
Yeah, we were involved a couple of years ago with a nationwide study that was looking carefully at the National Flood Insurance Program in coastal regions. And basically, on the East Coast now, in many of the barrier islands, you cannot get that insurance because they're so hurricane flood prone. I think in California, because there aren't that many people really living, if we're talking about coastal flooding versus river flooding, not that many people in those situations. And my guess sort of is if you're in a really hazardous location, you can't get it. Mm-hmm. And if you're in a hazardous location, your deductibles are often so high you never collect. And right now there's, just to throw this in because earthquakes have come up, there's these flyers that have come out saying you're eligible for earthquake insurance. And it's exactly the same situation. These are not state or federal programs. They're private companies in many cases. But if you're in a really hazardous location, a fault zone, I don't think you can get earthquake insurance. And for everybody else, the deductibles are so high, it's 15%. So that if you live in a modest $1 million house today in the Bay Area, your deductible is $150,000. It sounds like a great deal, but you will probably never collect on that policy.
We've been talking a lot about how California is a little bit more conscious about sea level rise and issues of flooding and global climate change. I'm curious, is there a conversation yet, and I know this is a little controversial, about making sure people don't build in these areas, or maybe moving people out? Because there's been a conversation in terms of Harvey about if the private insurance companies aren't insuring these folks because there's too much risk, should we be insuring them, or should we maybe be thinking of building somewhere else?
Really good question. And I think there's two parts to that. One is, should we be insuring people repeatedly? One of my graduate students just finished up his thesis, and one of them was in Florida in reinsurance and multiple claims. Some people have made 8, 10, 11 claims that are still being honored. Other people don't have the insurance. So that program is now, I don't know, billions of dollars in debt. Mm-hmm. And I think there's, I mean, insurance is a great form of sort of social subsidy. You know, we don't think our house is going to burn down. We pay for it forever, and somebody's does, and they get paid off, or car insurance. But when it revolves around a natural hazard that we can identify, we know the areas that are prone to it, I see no reason why we should, you know, everybody should get one free flood, maybe.
Right.
And then say, okay, we're not going to allow you to rebuild. And I will say the California Coastal Commission today, which is our main regulatory agency for coastal construction, is looking more and more carefully at any coastal development. There's still a lot of controversy and a lot of politics involved and people pushing projects and so forth and so on. But they're looking really carefully at these issues, and sea level rise now is a big part of what people have to deal with either reconstruction or new development.
So the conversation is starting to happen here. That's interesting. We have Gail from Pacifica. Hey, Gail, welcome to Forum.
Thank you. I love your show.
Thanks.
My question is, our city council has started talking about managed retreats, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that and the effect that that's going to have on communities who just cannot afford to protect their coastline and the homes that are right there.
Yeah, Gary Griggs, can you just quickly explain what managed retreat is?
With sea level rise and with sea level rise and coastal erosion, coastal retreat, and Pacifica is a, whether you want to think it as a great example or a bad example, is been sort of in the news because of what's happening with the bluffs and apartments, mm-hmm. and so forth. We can armor. We can build more seawalls, more revetments, more levees, more barriers. And that in California is now being discouraged because of other impacts. We can try to accommodate it, and that's kind of live with it for a while, like maybe the Embarcadero. You let the water come in and you let it go out. And the other is, what we are ultimately going to have to move towards is managed retreat. And if it's not managed, it's going to be unmanaged. So today is sort of, you know, we're right on the edge. We're right on the cusp of what we were talking about earlier, Queen, and we've got power plants and sewage treatment plants. When do you push the button and say, we've got to move back? And I understand and sympathize with those people who have been enjoying, you know, oceanfront locations or, you know, beach level living or cliff tops. But this globe, this nation, this state cannot deal with 100 feet of sea level rise. Can we deal with 50 or 20 or 10? Or when does it get so expensive you simply have to move back? And that's what we mean by managed retreat. We plan it. We do it in a logical, sequential way for those at most risk structures that are most needed moving back first.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to UC Santa Cruz oceanographer Gary Griggs about the challenges facing our coastal zones and how we can protect them. He's got a book out called Coasts in Crisis. And if you want to join the conversation, give us a call, 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. And Gary, I got to ask, because you mentioned it twice, you mentioned the seawalls and how they're problematic, but you didn't want to get into it. But I guess I'm going to ask you to get into it, because I often hear that this is sort of the solution to this problem. And I've been like, yeah, that sounds reasonable. Just build a seawall. What's the issue there?
What's the problem? Well, they benefit, at least for the short to intermediate term, the homeowner, the highway, whatever the facility is we're trying to protect. And clearly, the Dutch have been doing this for centuries, although they're major levees, not seawalls. But there are clearly impacts of seawalls on public beaches, and it's those issues that the Coastal Commission has become more concerned with. So part of it is what you build. Is it a big pile of rocks, what we could call a riprap revetment, which take up huge areas of beach? They can impede, or a seawall, which is generally a vertical structure. Ocean Beach in San Francisco is a concrete seawall. It can obstruct both lateral access along the shoreline at high tide or vertical access down to the beach. It can take up valuable beach space. Mm-hmm. It cuts off the sand that would have been eroded from the cliff or the bluff from reaching the beach. Many of these are visually pretty unattractive to the beachgoer. And there's also something that fits with our other conversation, which is sea level rise. Where there is no barrier, where there is no road or highway or seawall, the shoreline will continue to retreat and move inland, and we will maintain a beach. So that's been happening for the last 20,000 years. We had nothing in the way. But if you look today, 10% of California's coast is now armored with some sort of wall. And in Southern California, it's 30%. So as sea level rises, we're going to essentially cover or drown or flood the beach in front of those walls. So we protect what's behind it, but we lose this recreational area for literally tens of millions of people. So those are some of the issues.
We've got a call from Martin in Santa Clara. Hey, Martin, welcome to Forum.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. My question is, the moon continues to move away from the Earth. I think in my lifetime, it's probably moved three or four feet. What effect is that? Of course, that affects the tides, but, you know, is that having an effect on sea level rise or ice melt or anything like that?
I would say no impact on ice melt. I'd say with the dimensions you mentioned, several feet, with the forces that are at play here, I mean, it's 250,000 miles away on average. A few feet is immeasurable or not significant in any near future time frame.
Let's go to Dale in San Francisco. Dale, welcome to Forum.
Thank you for taking my call. Quite some time ago, a few years ago maybe, I heard a proposal of towing icebergs down from the Arctic to the coast here in California to mitigate our
drought
problem.
Yeah.
And also by removing those icebergs, which are fresh water, would that contribute to mitigating sea level rise to some degree?
So I guess the idea is if we drank that water rather than letting it melt into the sea, would that help this issue that you've flagged of sea level rise? I'm not sure if that's even really possible. Do you have a comment on that, Gary, or should we just go to the next phone call?
No, it's interesting because that was put out, gosh, it might have been several decades ago, and they actually funded the RAND Corporation to see what it costs to take icebergs from Antarctica. You could take them from the Arctic, wrap them in saran wrap, essentially plastic, and then tow them with nuclear tugs to California, then anchor them off San Pedro or something. And they were figuring out how much it would melt. I think the cost is really expensive. Much of that would have melted by the time they got here.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
It's a long way. It's about 10,000 miles. And then you've got it sitting, you know, off of a major populated area with major harbors and ships. You know, say this thing is 10 miles long. That becomes a bit of a problem. So I think that was interesting, but dismissed. And I would say in terms of sea level rise, we're still going to drink it just like, or use it just like we would a river flow. And then it goes back into the ocean again. So it's all recycled.
Right. Well, we have a question from Ellen, and I love these sort of questions because she asks, could you explain how sea level rise is measured? I don't really understand how you measure sea level rise. And I have to say, I don't really understand it either, other than I know that it's rising and how many inches. So how is it by the tide line, or how do you do that?
So historically, going back to about the mid-1800s, we started installing a tide gauge. And San Francisco at the Golden Gate has the oldest in the country. It goes back to about 1855. Originally put in for navigation, basically it records the water level. So it rises and falls with the tide. And you can see over time, in fact, you can go online. There's a NOAA website, and there's hundreds of these around the world. And you can actually see the variations with seasons and El Niños, but you can see this rise of about 7.5 inches over the last century. The problem is those tide gauges are all anchored on land. They're tied to solid rock or concrete or something, and the land may be rising or sinking. So those were all local measurements that were averaged up until about 1993, and we weren't sure if those were good averages. 1993, we launched a couple of satellites, and we're now measuring ocean surface elevation from space through something called satellite altimetry. And what that requires, you can imagine, is very, very precisely knowing exactly where those satellites are relative to the Earth. And they're essentially sending radar beams off of the ocean surface, millions of those over time. And we're now able to measure it within a tenth of a millimeter a year, which to me is an amazing engineering accomplishment.
Well, we are headed to the end of the show right now. We've been talking to Gary Griggs, professor of earth sciences at UC Santa Cruz. He's also the author of a new book called Coasts in Crisis, A Global Challenge. Gary Griggs, thanks so much for joining us on Forum.
Thank you, Quina.
And I'm Quina Kim. You've been listening to Forum, and thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.